Yeah, so my topic is the order. It's called the order in the world. I'm not very good with finding titles for talks. I usually can't do that. So I think a few weeks ago when we planned this, we had the idea of calling my talk "The Order in the World." So basically, I talk about the altruistic dimension of being an order member. In his first talk, Paramavacara talked about the three areas where an order member works on: its own practice, harmony in the sangha, in the order, and the altruistic dimension, the going out. So I'm going to talk about the third area. I assume much of what I'm going to say will be familiar to you, but there will be some repetition, so not much new stuff in it. And I also may repeat a few things which Suwata said yesterday, because of talking about the life of an alderman will involve some altruistic dimension. So there may be some repetition, but it makes it easier to remember. So basically, the altruistic dimension is inherent in going for refuge and being an order member. One of Bhante's important teachings, in our group, we sort of try to find out what are Bhante's of distinctive teachings. And one of them is the centrality of going for refuge. And this going for refuge, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, has of different aspects. Yeah. So going for refuge is the volitional aspect, the going, the doing something. Going forth is the aspect of changing one's life, looking at one's life and one's lifestyle. And one aspect of going for refuge is the altruistic dimension, which is usually expressed in the language of the Bodhisattva ideal or the Bodhicitta. So this is part of going for refuge. I think that's an important teaching of Sangharakshita, that you can't have going for refuge without the altruistic dimension. What you have in the usual Indo-Tibetan system is that sort of the Bodhicitta sort of comes on top of going for refuge. First you go for refuge, and you've done that, then you have the Bodhicitta, the altruistic dimension. You can sort of almost choose whether you want to go that way or not. But in the way Bhante sees it, the Bodhicitta, the altruistic dimension, is part of going for refuge. So you can't be without it. At the ordination ceremony, because of this, because there's a certain aspect of going for refuge, we don't have a bodhisattva ordination in the order. It's only one ordination. So we don't have a special bodhisattva ordination. Because in a way, from a certain point of view, our ordination is a bodhisattva ordination. Yeah. At the public ordination, we have these acceptance verses, which we sometimes study on retreats here. And one of them is, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. Yeah. So, we accept our ordination for the benefit of all beings. Being ordained is not a private affair. It's not even something just within the order. It affects or should affect all beings. I had the sense when I was driven some sort of horrible early hour to my Guhaloka course, getting up in the middle of the night, being driven to Gatwick Airport. I had this vague sense, being sort of half awake, dozing in the car, that sort of something really significant is about to happen, and not just for me. I had this sort of sense when I drove to the airport. So yes, our ordination is for the benefit of all beings. So it's not optional. Yeah? The altruistic dimension of one's order life is just part of it. Yeah, it's not optional. Also, the image of the order, or the symbol of the order, is the 1,000-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. Yeah. I'm sure you're all familiar with that image, that teaching of the order being a reflection of the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, and each order member being one hand of Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion. I'm sort of stating the obvious, really. Yeah? It's the Bodhisattva of compassion. So no compassion, no Avalokiteshvara. The hands of Avalokiteshvara reach out. Yeah? They don't sort of have different implements and reach out to the world. Yeah, they don't fight amongst each other. Yeah, or they don't hold each other intensely. They actually reach out. In other words, if this altruistic dimension is missing, it's not an order. Yeah, it's not the 1,000 Avalokiteshvara, and it's not an order in that sense. So yes, I mean sort of basic teaching from Sangharakshita. This altruism, this bodhisattva ideal, is inherent part of going for refuge, And it's inherent part of being an order member. Yeah, it's part of what being an order member is about. Our ordination is not just about us. Now, I'm sure you all heard this, so I want to look at sort of why, sort of the sort of Buddhist arguments behind this. So I want to go a bit about into Buddhist doctrine and teachings. Basic Buddhist teachings, Four Noble Truths, and you all heard them. First two, truth of suffering, dukkha, and the truth of the origin of suffering, tanha or craving. That's sort of the basic Buddhist description of samsara. Yeah, that's sort of our situation. Yeah. It's not very satisfying, there's something wrong all the time, yeah. Things are never quite right, and to a large extent, it's our own fault. It's craving which leads to dukkha. And craving stands here for all sorts of selfish, self-centered emotions. Yeah. So it's our self-centered tendencies and emotions which lead to suffering. I mean, obviously, when we get into trouble, there's other factors there as well. It's not only us. Yeah, I'm not saying everything which happens to us due to our own actions. But to a large extent, it is our actions, as well as outer conditions, other circumstances. But for practical purposes, we mainly look at what we've done to get into a difficult situation. That's what the First Noble Truths are about. Yeah? Yes, there is dukkha, there is suffering in life. Obviously, that has different conditions. Nothing has only one condition. Yeah? It's basic Buddhist truth. But for practical purposes, mainly look at our own, what we've done to get into this mess. Yeah? That's the First Noble Truth, yeah? Dukkha, tanha, craving. So this craving, I mean, this tanha, in a sense, I would rephrase as short-sighted self-concern, yeah? Or blind self-cherishing, yeah? Or worrying about oneself in a not very intelligent way. That leads to suffering. I mean, you can do that as an exercise. Think of examples of difficult, messy situations you find yourselves in. Yeah, sort of, you know, sort of difficult situations one can be in. Yeah, sort of a mess. At the beginning of that was usually some sort of urge for happiness. You have some sort of vague, blind idea, if I do this, I will become happy. Yeah, and then we end up in a mess. Yeah, so it's our sort of striving for happiness, which is very short-sighted, very blind, yeah, which gets us into trouble. I'm not going to, I'm not advocating a guilt trip, by the way. It's just sort of, it's more about taking responsibility. I did this exercise sort of on the retreat in Vajraloka 2 months ago on the system of meditation, where I had people reflecting exactly on this first, on the truth of dukkha. Yeah. I just ask people to reflect on the difficult situation they find themselves in and then look at sort of what they've done to get into it. And it was really interesting what came out. One person talked about his marriage and he said, well, I was just sort of, I should have done more research before I got into it. He said, I think that's the way he put it. Or get more information, sort of way of putting it. Yeah. But then I asked him whether it would have been realistically expected of him to have done that. He said, no. I mean, not realistically. Yeah. But it's actually quite a useful exercise to do. Just think about sort of difficult situation you find yourselves in and just think how you got into it. And mainly look at what you've done. It's about taking responsibility. It's about not blaming. Yeah. I think there's a more subtle way in which this sort of self-cherishing is suffering. It doesn't really lead to suffering. It's not a sort of punishment thing. It's more of it is unpleasant. I'm not sure I'm the only one who's done doing this. Often there's a sort of self-obsessed commentary going on all the time in my life, there's sort of subtitles, which refer everything that happens to me. Yeah? So when I lead a study group, it's not just, oh, I hope the people enjoy it, I hope they like me. It's a self-referential. Yeah? When there's an order weekend, how will I cope with all these people? Yeah, it's sort of, there's always sort of self-referential commentary going on. Yeah, and I think that's actually suffering. This sort of subtle, in a sense, if you could just stop it, life would be much easier. If you were to just stop referring everything which happens to ourselves, what is self-worrying, yeah, I expect life to be much easier. much freer. In the Bodhicharyavatara, Shantideva, obviously is using very strong language, he calls this the enemy. Yeah, our greatest enemy is our blind self-cherishing. That's the enemy, which gets us into trouble, and which we have to stamp out. Yeah. He's using very strong language on this. Basically, our greatest enemy is our own mind. Which is sort of, if you look at it, it seems to be in line with our experience. Yeah. It seems what life seems to be like. Yeah. It's our own mind which sort of gets us into trouble, which is troublesome. Yeah, we need to stamp it out, sort of destroy it. It's a language Shantideva uses. So this is sort of, yes, continuous referring everything to oneself, worrying about oneself, and all that going on all the time. So to stop that, you just sort of turn around and worry more about others. I mean, that's a trick. Yeah. That's what Shantideva calls the greatest mystery, the exchange of self and other. Yeah. The same worrying we have about ourselves, it gets all very heavy and sort of inward looking, just sort of turn it around and apply it to others. Worry more about others than yourself, and life is easier. It sounds easy, but it goes against the grain. Yeah. And Shantideva calls this the greatest mystery. Yeah, the greatest mystery is the exchange of self and other. So this is some sort of Buddhist background from Buddhist doctrine on the whole teaching of altruism being part of going for refuge. Yeah. Also, quite logically, if we want to gain insight, which I'm sure we all want, yeah, which means we want to see reality, and reality is, I am not special. That's what's special about me, that's reality. Yeah. There's a beautiful reading you can get from the Bodhicharyavatara. It's basically very simple. I don't want to suffer, others don't want to suffer. What's so special about my suffering? I want to be happy, others don't want to be happy. What's so special about my happiness? It's very simple, and so very, very true. Yeah, so in acting altruistic, and sort of, yeah, getting away from the self-centeredness, we act more in line with reality. And that is also the way to non-duality. Yeah. So inside, non-duality comes from altruism. From putting others before us, before you. So that's of the theoretical background. I want to now, maybe for the rest of the talk, talk about how to do this as an order member. Yes, I want to apply this basic Buddhist principle to the life of an order member. And I'm going to just give a few examples and areas that we can work on. So it's not going to be exhaustive, it's clear. Yeah. Yeah, so quite simply, there's our practice of the precepts. I mean, that's altruism. Just practicing the 5 or 10 precepts is altruistic activity. Because when we act ethically, we are concerned with others. We're really stating obvious things here, I know, but I think it's, again, good to remind us of that. Yeah? So we are concerned about others. And acting ethically means we are aware of the effects our actions have on other people. Recently, Bhante gave a book launch on living ethically. And he made 2 points. I think I remember two, maybe 3 points, but two I want to stress. One is, ethics is a question of imagination, so our ability to imagine being another person. Just our ability to imagine another person is another person just as I'm a person. It's not another person is not an object which stands in my way, makes life pleasant or unpleasant for me, and so on. Another person is another person, and this person exists independent from me. Yeah, he has his own life. So that's the imagination, which is the basic for ethics. He makes another point, which very often we learn that ethics is a question of intention. Yeah, I'm sure you heard that and said it often enough. Yeah. So Buddhist ethics is not about rules, we all know all that, it's about intention. But what Bhante says, this teaching can be misapplied in being, again, overly concerned with one's own mind. Yeah? So if we stress too much that ethics is a question, is a matter of the right intention, again, we're in here, in our heads. rather than being with the other person. So actually, ethics is a question of intention, but actually it's about other, how we treat other people. And I often find in discussion, sometimes happen discussion on ethical points, it's a bit like the last argument when nothing else comes. It's we discuss some sort of difficult ethical question, and then somebody says, oh, in the end it's only a matter of intention, and that kills the discussion. This sort of sometimes happens in discussions. But I don't think it's good enough. Really, it's about the other person. So, obviously part of our practice of altruism is being ethical. Bhante says something, so we've got the 5 or 10 precepts in the order of the 10 precepts. In the Yogi's Joy, Bhante says something interesting about the first precept. Quite amazing, really. So the first precept, not killing, no violence, we know that. If the first precept seems straightforward, if you think you can more or less forget about it, you are completely misunderstanding the nature of basic practices. So if you think, well, I'm not hurting anybody physically, I'm not even hurting anybody verbally, I'm all right with the first precept. That is a complete misunderstanding of the principles of basic practices. Not hurting or harming living beings is a good start. But if you leave it at that, you are going to be applying the precept in a fairly crude and unthinking way. It should be much more creative than a self-imposed restriction on your violent and destructive impulses. And then he says, the first precept includes the quality of mindfulness in one's relations with others. And then he goes more specific, what it means to follow the first precept. And what it comes down to is treating another being as a growing being, a developing being. So what he says is, when we really look at the first precept, we should treat other people as people who can evolve, who can develop, as developing beings, on that basis. So in a sense, not even treating people as how they are now, with their limitations, but treating people with all their potential. That is the first precept in the Yogi's Joy. Probably come back to the Yogi's Joy later, which sort of qualifies that later on. But the point is if you're really practicing the first precept, means treating other people as people who can grow and develop, not just as how they are now. Which sort of leads to my next point. There are many ways in which we act ethically, in which we act altruistically. I mean, helping all sorts of people, nothing wrong with that, helping the homeless and so on, good thing. However, as an order, we can have a special contribution, which is giving the Dharma. I think that's in a sense, that's a special contribution we as order members or prospective order members can have. When I wrote this down, that's sort of part of our practice as order members, making the Dharma available, I noticed I wasn't quite happy with the idea of giving the Dharma. I don't think it's enough. It's actually giving the 3 jewels. I think if you restrict the idea of, horrible word, teaching, the Dharma, you just end up giving people information and techniques. But really, we are giving the 3 jewels. So when we give the Dharma, or if we are active at centers, or in any sort of situation where we engage with people, we give the Buddha, in a sense of, give the vision of what it can be to be a human being, what human existence can be like. We give the Dharma, the methods and the teachings, and we give the Sangha, it's of the community. It's also something we can give. So maybe we shouldn't think so much in terms of giving the Dharma and teaching the Dharma as giving the 3 jewels. So if it gives the whole package. Giving the Buddha, the vision, giving the Dharma, the methods and teachings, and giving the Sangha, giving a vision of the Sangha, of community. And that on all levels. We have beginners, meditation classes up to helping people to get ordained. I mean, there's something on the importance of Sangha. In our group at the beginning, the first day, I think quite a few groups did this, we had this round where we talked about our relation to the order and the movement. And it was quite common for many of us that the Sangha jewel was the last one to understand. Yeah. For quite a few of us, it was actually the Buddha and the Dharma which came first. Yeah. And Sangha, I think Sangha jewel came in a certain way, the Sangha jewel came later. Or the understanding of the significance of the Sangha jewel came later. I mean, I'm not sure, probably not for everybody, but I think for most people, quite a few, this is our way into Buddhism. Yeah. I think for most of us, Sangha is more sort of the people you have to put up with if you want to meditate. The people sort of, for practical reasons, it's easier to do it in a group sort of idea. Yeah. But I'm not sure whether that's actually true. I mean, if I look at myself, I mean, I know that Sangha came last for me. Yeah, sort of much more into the Dharma and maybe the Buddha, but Sangha came last. At the same time, it was actually people which kept me. Yeah. So yesterday, Suwata mentioned these sort of two brains we have, this sort of brain here and the head and the bowel. Yeah, so if you remember that probably. Maybe you could say that for most of us, sort of Buddha and Dharma are sort of in this brain. But the Sangha works more in this brain, sort of the bowels, yeah, sort of where really things happen. I'm sure that the theories can be developed further. So even if on a conscious level we're not into Sangha, I think we actually are. It's basically the people which kept us. Yeah? It's the people being friendly to us. I think it's just we weren't aware that it is a refuge and a jewel. Yeah? It's something to always take for granted. So a few general points on sort of how to do this. There's an interesting list in Buddhism, which I was going to mention, and I'm not going to go into the details of the list, but the principle of the list. So how to give people the three jewels, or how to get people into the Sangha, how to create Sangha. The traditional list are the four Sangraha Vastus, which are called the means of conversion, or the means of unification. So the same things you do to unite a Sangha are the same you do to create Sangha, to sort of draw people into the Sangha. And they are basically, it comes down to friendship. Yeah. These four are generosity. Basically, I mean, if you're generous, you're making contact with people. Yeah. I think some time ago, Subhuti gave talks on how to meet in a chapter. And for some reason, I remember this point. He talked about in terms of the Sangraha Vastus. He said, it's a good idea in a chapter when somebody always brings biscuits or chocolate. I think it sort of helps to create harmony. For some reason, that's a point I remember. But I think it's actually true. Yeah, I think there's some real truth in it. So generosity, kindly speech, which again, obvious. Yeah, people thrive on kindly speech. Doing good, just of being helpful, doing good, and exemplification. Exemplification does not mean you have to be perfect. Yeah? You just have to be seen making an effort. Yeah, so exemplification doesn't mean sort of as soon as the meditation class starts you have to sort of become the perfect Buddhist and then you can relax afterwards. Yeah? But it actually means you're just being seen making an effort. So, I mean, I don't intend to go into these four in detail. You may want to do that in the group tomorrow. But the basic principle is, it's all about that, I don't like the word here, techniques of friendship or ways of forming friendships. So, again, the ways of uniting the Sangha and creating it, making it attractive, are the same thing. Just treat people in a friendly way. That's what all comes down to, just be friendly to people. Again, taking a point from Surata yesterday, I said there will be quite a few references to Surata's talk in my talk. So Okay, this helping people to deepen their going for refuge, as we say, to help people into the Sangha, into the order, happens on different levels. Yeah, there's of the basic open meditation class level. Yeah, so people come along, expect relaxation and learn to meditate, sort of level, up to helping people to get ordained in a very direct way, up to men who've asked for ordination, women who've asked for ordination. So all this sort of range. So I'm going to talk about a few of those levels, I call them. So if one is involved in a center, and Suwota gave a strong advice, support classes, go to class at the center, go to activities and support them. So if one does that, it is actually tricky. I was talking about this with friends in Germany recently. There are certain difficulties or problems which can arise when one is involved in teaching Buddhism or meditation. Yeah. And the difficulties seem to circle around the word teacher or teaching. I mean, there's a bit of a misunderstanding. This is quite subtle in a way, point. Quite difficult to get, really. On the one hand, I would assume that somebody who's ordained is in some way involved in passing on the Dharma. Yeah, in some form, it's called a teaching, for that matter. At the same time, being an order member does not mean being a teacher. It's not a teacher certificate. Yeah. It's not a license to teach, being ordained. So I would give the advice, the idea, don't think yourself as a teacher, but think of yourself as being involved in teaching. Yeah. I mean, maybe to explain what I mean by the difference, to give an analogy. Bhante says we shouldn't think of ourselves as being bodhisattvas, because we as persons can't be bodhisattvas, it's too much. We can think of ourselves as being involved in bodhisattva activity, and that's sort of more sane, more helpful. And maybe in a similar way, it's not useful to think of oneself as a teacher with all the horrible connotations that can have, all the difficulties, but more being involved in teaching activities. Because the word teacher is loaded, it can either mean just handing on information, which is not what Buddhism is, what is what we are about, it's not just about giving people information, so you can get it from books or from Google. And also, the word teacher has some sort of weird spiritual status effect to it, sort of your special sort of person who knows what's good for others. I think it's really dangerous if you get into that position. So it's best not to think of oneself as a teacher in the self-conscious way, but rather than being involved in teaching. There's actually a funny bit in this. It just follows on from Bhante's description of the first precept to help people growing. He says basically you do this by not being in their way and not messing around with them. He quotes D.H. Lawrence, who said about parenting, the first principle is to leave the child alone, and that's also the second and the third. Now, I'm not a parent. I'm not sure if D.H. Lawrence actually was a parent. But let that be. That's first probably true in the Sangha. Yeah, so if you want to help people, at least get out of the way. Don't stand in the way. And then Bhante says, do we really know what is truly best for someone? Do we really know what constitutes growth and development for them as an individual? It is remarkable how sometimes a person who has only the vaguest idea of the direction of their own life is taking can be quite definite in their analysis of the practice of others. So this is the first precept, just stand clear. So yeah, don't get into the sort of mode where you think you know what's good for others and tell them. It's difficult to know what's good for oneself. Yeah, so supporting classes, teaching meditation, it's probably better not to think of myself as a teacher, but rather than sort of as somebody involved in teaching. Few other points on that. If you support a class or teach meditation, obviously make sure you're in a good mental state. Yeah. Or if you are not, you should be skilled enough not to let the other people suffer from it. Yeah. We can't be happy. I mean, it's not that it's required to be cheerful, happy, and bouncy when you go into a class, but at least sort of be friendly. Yeah. And if you're grumpy, don't let them feel it. It may actually be good to let someone else lead the class. I think I did this once in Essen. I think I spent the whole afternoon at the computer doing bookkeeping. And then it was due to lead meditation. I just said, oh, I can't do this. It's impossible. I had someone else doing it. So it's important to make sure you're in a good mental state yourself. Also, go on retreat regularly as a participant. I think that keeps oneself fresh. Otherwise, what happens is once one gets into a sort of routine of teaching meditation, you sort of you come up with the same sentences every time, the same jokes, and sort of the team really gets bored with your jokes because they've heard them 10 times and all this. These things happen actually. Yeah, sort of keep it fresh and go on retreat regularly, and be open to feedback. I think that's what Sota said yesterday, 2 days ago as well. So being involved in classes, in a sense, is an incentive to work on oneself. Yeah. So not only for one's own sake, one should be in a good state for others as well. Yeah. Be in a good state for other people as well. And do it as a team. I mean, it comes back to this point of we give Sangha, we don't only give the Dharma. I mean, people who go off alone and start activities are heroic, that's great. But in a sense, it's very difficult because it's much easier to, depend on the people you're working with actually, on the whole it's much easier to do it as a team. Yeah? Because that's what people find attractive. I know what I find attractive is seeing other people cooperating well. Yeah? Seeing people being good friends is really inspiring. I think there's of more, if you have just some individual good teachers, that's a good thing. But if these individual good teachers are friends, and are seen to be friends, that's a real inspiration. Yeah. In a sense, that's a real teaching. Yeah. So work with friends, do it as a team. But as Suwata said, it's difficult and there will be blood. Yeah, so cooperation is not easy. Another point. Communities and businesses, sort of team-based, red-level businesses, of the so-called institutions of the what used to be called, or what's still called, the new society. Yeah. Okay, living in them, much more intense. You can't run away from the Sangha. Yeah. You can't lead a double life, which I think many of us do if we don't live full-time in a Buddhist context. It's sort of in good behavior on retreats, in Padmaloka, and in the center, and at home, who knows? Yeah. Who knows what you're all doing, what we're all doing. So if you're full-time in a community, work with other Buddhists, it's much more intense. And it's a great opportunity. I like the expression Sword had yesterday. It's an opportunity to forget about oneself. Yeah, because it's a great opportunity just to give, just to work for others. And we are in them, those of us who are in those institutions, not only for ourselves, but also for the others in it and for posterity. Yeah, for those generations after. I think something to bear in mind. Yeah. So if you live in a community and the community is difficult, there may be a good reason for keep going for those coming later. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying one should. I mean, I didn't do it. I moved out of a community once. But there's a good reason for just keep going because there are later generations of enthusiastic mitras coming and it would be good if something's there for them. Yeah. So there's an altruistic dimension in our institutions. Communities and businesses. Last area I want to talk about. So that's basically on the level of teaching beginners and sort of lifestyle. I mean, there's all everything between that. Yeah, sort of, it's very interesting after ordination to sort of sit in with other study leaders, support study group. It's really interesting. You see how other people do it. And you learn, you don't really learn teaching skills, but you sort of take them on. So the big area, probably maybe the most central area in altruistic activity in the life of an order member, is helping people to join the order. This is not business or work. It shouldn't be dealt with as a sort of organizational problem. It's part of practice. Um, When you ask for ordination in a particular center, I'm not sure if you're aware of that, you ask to join a chapter. Usually, I mean, we want to make sure that when you get ordained, there's a chapter for you there. Yeah. So from the orders member's point of view, from the other side, from the orders side, a person who asks for ordination is a possible chapter member. Yeah. It's not somebody who just wants to join the order in the abstract. Yeah. If it's somebody at the place I live, it's somebody who wants to be with me. Yeah. So it's only polite, even, a question of good manners, to be interested in the person. So ideally, in an ideal world, all order members would be interested in helping people to get ordained. Yeah, I mean, there's practical things, of course, because of time, and it's good to have people who specialize more in this. But in principle, it's part of being an order member, being interested in it, at least. And I think the word interest is important here. Yeah? I mean, when I got ordained, I joined the chapter in Croydon, and immediately I was thrown into discussing ordination requests. I didn't know the people. But there's no argument. Yeah? I mean, one, I can get to know them, and second, I can at least be interested what others have to say about them. Yeah? So at least being interested in them. And this is actually a practice. In my relation to the order, but this has something quite amazing about this. Just some background. My relation to the order is a paper Banti have given in 1990. It's meant to be a sort of second volume coming after the history of my going for refuge. I think it came a few years later, actually. So it follows on from that, in Banti's thinking. And in this paper, again, Suwota said, become familiar with Banti's teachings and books and read them again and again and again. This is one of them which I suggest you read really often. And actually, no, don't read, listen to the talk. Yeah, I think I highly recommend listen to the talk a few times a year. It's a really important text. And I think it had a bit of a comeback lately, when Banti's message came out in the paper entitled What is the Western Buddhist Order? Sometimes also known as Banti's Message, also known as Last Will and Testament. Because there was a theory that Banti contradicts himself from this earlier paper. But actually he doesn't. Yeah. It follows on from this. So Banti's Message is a continuation of this paper. It's a restatement of this paper, actually. I think it's a really important text. And again, listen to it, because Banti cracks some jokes there. And if you just read it, you may not get them. And then you may get upset. apparently that happened in discussion when it came out. So Banti has all these horrible things about himself, and yeah, being a Russian spy, an American agent, a misogynist, and all these sort of things. He was actually joking. If you listen to the talk, you know it. If not, you can get really horrible discussions and get really upset. So listen to the talk. Yeah. Actually, a really funny one. So this was given in 1990. And in the beginning of the paper, he talks about all these sort of changes which happened in the movement then. One of the biggest changes was the establishment of the Padmaloka ordination process. So inaugurated mainly by Subhuti and others in, I think, 88. Actually, just an aside, this ordination process sort of started in 88. We are still thriving on that. I mean, it went through various phases since then. Yeah? But in a sense, the foundations were laid then. So it was quite successful, still working. So Subhuti became a preceptor then, and he talked about, I think he wrote about in Shabda, that conferring ordination is a very big responsibility, and in doing that, his own going for refuge is called into question. Yeah. So in assessing, in witnessing somebody else's going for refuge, one's own going for refuge is called into question. Yeah. Because that's what Subhuti says about being a preceptor. And then Banti takes that point and broadens it out. So I quote, so that's Banti quoting Subhuti, in witnessing someone else's going for refuge, my own is called into question. End of quote. So then Banti says, this is the real crux of the matter. And it's the crux of the matter, not just for those who have the actual responsibility of conferring ordinations. It is also the crux, the decisive point at issue, for all members of ordination teams, and indeed for each and every individual Dhammachari and Dhammacharini who entertains an opinion, expressed or unexpressed, and such opinions ought always be expressed, on the readiness or unreadiness for ordination of any mitra or friend who wishes to go for refuge to the Three Jewels, within the context of the Western Buddhist order. In a sense, it is ultimately the crux for the whole order. For it is the whole order which indirectly, if not directly, witnesses the ordinees going for refuge. So, what Subhuti says about being a preceptor, but he broadens out to every order member. So, as soon as you're ordained, you'll probably be involved in other people's of wanting to join the order, wanting to join your chapter. And as soon as that happens, you're going to have an opinion. You probably will have an opinion. You ought to express that opinion. And then your ongoing for refuge is called into question. Yeah, I mean, you can have these sort of discussions that, for example, you may point out that the person asking for ordination doesn't meditate on a regular basis. And then you sort of think, and actually, I don't. So in discussing somebody else's meditation, I think, well, if I expect it of him, what about me? Yeah? Yeah. Or if we look at people's sort of consumption of alcohol, well, what would be the alcohol consumption of the order members? So whenever you do this, your ongoing refuge is called into question. Yeah. And that is a practice. It's quite, can be quite an intense practice. So yes, being involved in helping people to join the order is a practice. It's not a business point, and it's in a sense what's part of being an order member is about. And I must say, it's a really interesting and inspiring. I mean, it can be really inspiring as well. I mean, it's not just hard work and soul searching and sort of challenging. It can be very inspiring as well. Okay, so these are some areas in which we practice altruism after ordination or even before ordination. Or maybe just come back to this. That's the point I'd like to make. So yes, in chapters, you will have discussions on ordination requests. Before ordination, we've got going for refuge groups, and I know quite a few of you are probably in going for refuge groups, yeah, sort of, which are sometimes called proto-chapters. Yeah. So very similar principles apply to chapters and going for refuge groups. Now, obviously, you don't have to discuss somebody's readiness for ordination in a going for refuge group. You can do that if you want, by the way. Maybe interesting, but you don't have to do that. Touchy. But you may be in the position of somebody wanting to join your going for refuge group. Yeah, or somebody at your local center asks for ordination. Yeah, or somebody moves to your center. Yeah. And then I think it's a very good attitude just to be open to them, just sort of invite them into the going for refuge group. I mean, I was quite impressed with the one of the Norwich going for refuge groups that Jonathan is in. Quite a very impressive. I just saw it from the outside when Jochen Bertz came to Padmaloka for a few months last year. And without any, as far as I understand, without any great debating, they just took him into the going for refuge group. Yeah. I found it really, that's a very good spirit and quite impressive. Yeah. As far as I know, there weren't any sort of questioning of one's own feelings or debating group dynamics. It was sort of, we want to get ordained, he wants to get ordained, so why not get him into the group? Yeah. I think that's a very generous spirit in which this can happen. Yeah, so support each other in your going for refuge. Just sort of 2 points to end with. They're not very thought out. So for me, it's a bit of a work in process. One is, I mentioned going on retreat on a regular basis. If you want, I mean, one should do it anyway. I mean, it's sort of obvious that one should go on retreat on a regular basis. I think especially if you're involved in sort of handing on the Dharma in any way, because if you have to be clear about meditation, keep your meditation alive. Personally, it's more a personal thing, very central, I think, are the Brahma Viharas. I think they're really sort of important Sangha emotions. On various levels. There was some sort of bit of advertising now for Brahma Vihara retreats. Yes, we run them here at Padmalok as well, and do come. Because what we do in the Brahma Viharas, we sort of train different emotions. And that's one aspect. The other aspect is we learn more about our emotional life. Suwata again said 2 days ago that in meditation we have to do bhavana practices because they go to the depth. Just sitting formlessly and watching one's mind, I know from experience, it can bring me in positive mental states. I know that. I can get sort of even friendly at doing that. But I know there's something missing. And working on the Brahma Viharas, we work much more detailed on our emotions. So one result is we get to know ourselves better. Just an example, sort of shock. I mean, I'm not really shocked by it, maybe I should be, is on the last Brahma Vihara retreat, I realized something about myself. It's actually I enjoy the suffering of people I don't like. I actually really enjoy it. But so I tend to justify it in those sort of dharmic ways, yeah. Sort of it's just the consequences of his actions, sort of, you know, sort of stuff, yeah. But it took me 3 Brahma Vihara retreats to come to that realization that I've got certain sadistic tendencies. So well, I found it really interesting. I mean, I wasn't shocked. Again, maybe I should be more shocked about it, but I wasn't shocked. I just found it very interesting. Just, oh yeah, actually, I quite appreciate when he suffers. So that's one reason to do Brahma Vihara retreats. You learn something about yourself. Yeah. And as I'm conscious of it now, I hopefully won't sort of make my enemies feel it. The other thing is, it just sort of trains our range of positive emotions towards other people. Yeah. Initially, I think that's really important if you engage in any sort of sangha activity. Yeah, so there's metta, obvious, yeah, sort of basic well-wishing. Metta is based. I'm going to simplify the metta bhavana now. It's very simple. First stage, I know I want to be happy. All other stages, I know other people want to be happy as well. Yeah. So this is basic truth which we reflect on in the metta bhavana. Karuna, yeah, so people suffer, you respond to that. Mudita, people have good qualities, you respond to that. Actually, I think mudita is sort of an underestimated positive emotion. It's the one of the Brahma Viharas where it's most difficult to find any literature on. Yeah? I think there's one booklet in German I found somewhere on the internet. But I think it's a really an important one because it's more fun. It's actually enjoyable. It's a positive emotion which is actually enjoyable. You enjoy the good qualities of others. And it helps counteracting envy and competitiveness. Yeah. It's a training against competitiveness. And I think Bhante said once that competitiveness is one of the sort of most damaging thing in the spiritual community. It's most damaged. So, mudita. Lastly, upekkha, which is the most difficult and most subtle of them. But I think that's a really important one in the Sangha. Because what you have in upekkha, on the one hand, you have a strong wish that the other person is happy. Yeah. On the other hand, you see they live their own lives. Yeah. You sort of live with the fact that although you wish them every good in the world, you wish them to develop, they've got to do their own developing. Yeah. So they do something as well. It's not just up to, don't get over-responsible about somebody else is going for refuge. You have to wish them well, you wish them to develop, but they actually have a life on their own and take decisions. So I think upekkha is quite an important also important kalinamitrata emotion, I find. Yeah, so just to put in this bit on the Brahma Viharas. I find it quite noticeable when I thought about the whole aspect of the altruistic dimension, how much I'm going to refer to one's own individual practice, yeah, going on retreat, do the Brahma Viharas, know yourself, and so on. Yeah, they're quite closely connected. Just to end with a few thoughts which they aren't really thought out. It's really a work in process for me, and maybe there's sort of a later talk coming out of that at some point. There's a very... I keep bringing up basic Buddhist teachings here, I know. One of them, which again you probably heard about, are the so-called 4 reminders, 4 thoughts which turn the mind to the Dharma. Yeah. Also called the 4 ordinary preliminary practices, 4 reflections. Yeah. 1, preciousness of human life, yeah, to realize actually you've got all the freedoms to practice. 2, that's going to end, death and impermanence. Three, karma, actions have consequences, we can take responsibility for our lives. Four, the sufferings of samsara. It gives a direction. I mean, samsara is a waste of time. So these are very brief, the four reflections. I think, I mean, they're usually applied to the human situation. That's how we usually look at them. But I think one can look at them in a specific way for order members. I was thinking about it recently, especially the first one, the precious opportunity. Yeah. So after ordination, not only are we human beings who can practice, we're actually members of the Theravada Buddhist order who can practice. Yeah. Which is a tremendous opportunity. It's tremendous because it's rare. Not many people get ordained in the world. It's a minute percentage of the world population is a member of the order. Yeah, it's very rare, and it's precious. And I think one thing which I find quite so saddening is when I see people after ordination in the sense of wasting their ordination. I think it's a danger that one wastes one's ordination if one sort of after ordination falls asleep, spiritually speaking. Yeah, so there's all this effort before ordination, yes, of going on retreats, going around the village again and again and again, yeah, order members, yeah, going to Sylvia, buying ice creams, yeah, talking to order members, all this sort of effort, spending lots of money on ordination course, all this sort of effort goes into it, and then the ordination, and sometimes that's it. Yeah, I think it's like a wasted opportunity. It was probably possible to specifically apply these four reminders to being an order member. Yeah? So it's a tremendous opportunity. It's rare. It's precious. In the sense of a lot of effort went into getting ordained. I mean, our own effort went into our ordination. Other people's effort as well. Yeah, people helped us. Yeah, don't forget that. We spend money on it, time. Yeah? So don't waste it after ordination. Make sure your post-ordination retreat isn't the last retreat you're on. It does actually happen at times. Yeah, so it's even more focused than just being the precious opportunity of being a human being, the precious opportunity of being an order member. And everything else follows from that. So it's a precious opportunity, don't waste it. It's impermanent, it's not going to last. You're going to die at some point. Yeah, yeah, it's going to happen. Don't know when. And our actions have consequences, we can make something of it. Yeah. And in the end, we are ordained to gain enlightenment, so getting out of samsara. Yeah. In a sense, let's not forget about enlightenment actually in all this. Yeah. In the end, ordination is about getting enlightened. Yeah. Yeah, so just some final exhortation before and especially after ordination of don't waste the precious opportunity. Thank you.